Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 296th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the top up-and-coming actresses in the business. Within 1 week this summer, she received an Emmy nomination for Best Supporting Actress in a limited series or TV movie for her portrayal of Anne Rankin, the great dancer and one-time romantic partner of Bob Fosse, in the FX limited series Fosse Verdon, and she attended the Hollywood premiere of Quentin Tarantino's film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in which she plays Pussycat, a fictional member of the Manson family, opposite Brad Pitt, and for which she has garnered rave reviews, the beautiful and talented Margaret Qualley. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, the 24-year-old daughter of the actress Andy McDowell reflects on her extensive background in dance and why she walked away from her pursuit of a career as a ballerina, tried modeling, and then walked away from that as well. How she wound up trying and falling in love with acting, the last thing she ever imagined herself doing. How her early roles on the TV series The Leftovers from 2014 through 2017, in a 2016 Spike Jonze-directed ad for Kenzo World Perfume, and in films such as the 2016 blockbuster The Nice Guys and the 2017 indie Novitiate, paved the way for her incredible 2019, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you. We always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living? I think you may have a more interesting answer than some as far as that.
I don't know about that. Thank you for having me. I was born in Montana, in Missoula. Well, I grew up like an hour outside of Missoula, a place called Nine Mile at first. And then you said, what do my parents do?
Yeah.
My mom is an actress, a very talented actress.
Can we give her a shout out?
Annie McDowell.
Yes.
And my dad, Paul Qualley, he's got a kind of unconventional job, but he basically builds houses by himself over the course of, you know, what's potentially 5 or so years, because he does it by himself.
Wow.
And makes these really beautiful, beautiful homes.
Wow.
And then, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess, because of what you've ended up doing, I have to ask, like, growing up, did you or your siblings, you know, was it sort of clear from the beginning that you had an interest in following in your mom's footsteps in a way? Or was that sometimes kids want to do anything but what their parents do? So,
yeah.
You know, where did you fall on that?
Well, I grew up dancing, and I was really serious about dance, and my sister danced as well. And I didn't really have any interest in acting when I was a kid because the only thing that I really liked on set was craft service. And, we didn't have that much candy in the household, and I would just kind of raid their candy. And
which sets were you on? Do you remember?
Gosh, the one I remember the most, I actually don't know what movie it was for, but yep. We went to this island on the coast of Italy, and that was really cool. It's a place called Panarea. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it was an active volcano that I stayed there for 2 months, and I was really little, and I just kind of wandered around because it was very safe, and collected tile and like named all the rocks in the ocean because I didn't have friends.
What else to do? Yeah.
yeah.
And were you know, like growing up, were you aware of the fact that this was the sort of, not only was this like mom's job, but it was, she was doing it at a high level. She was well known. People were seeing her. I mean, were you seeing her movies?
We didn't really grow up watching her movies because it was, I don't know, it was like your mom's all kissing another dude and doing strange stuff.
Right.
And so we didn't really watch a lot of movies when we were little. And then, you know, obviously when we got older, I watched her, and she's obviously so remarkably talented and all that. But no, she was just my mom. I was really fortunate in that regard. And I think that was intentional for her, you know, to have us be raised in North Carolina and have just a pretty simple childhood. I feel really privileged. So
when and why did, this is a very important question, when and why did Sarah Margaret Qualley become Margaret Qualley?
Oh, I grew up Sarah Margaret for sure. Yeah. And when anybody calls me Sarah Margaret, I feel like they've known me for a long time. It makes me feel like a little kid in a nice way. But basically what happened was I moved to New York when I was 16.
Yep.
And they were like, no, it's Sarah or Margaret.
Yeah,
and then I looked around the room, and there was 3 Sarahs in my grade. And I was like, okay, Margaret it is. I feel like an old woman anyway, so I might as well embrace my old woman name.
Right, it's like a Gertrude. You could bring
exactly,
that back.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so I want to come back to the dancing because there's sort of, that was a big part of your life.
Yeah.
And it continues to show up in the work once in a while. So why do you think initially, just even as a little kid, you were drawn to that?
I don't know if I can really express it properly, but I just love it. I took a dance class this morning. It makes me get out of my head, and I love the music, and I love just, it just makes me very, very happy. And I think that's what it was for me initially. And then eventually I got into ballet, which is obviously amazing as well. But I think once I started doing that, I started forgetting what I loved about dancing in the first place. And it became more about just trying to be perfect. And I went off to a boarding school for ballet, and I was really doing it a lot, you know, like 6 to 8 hours a day and all that kind of stuff.
Was that North Carolina School of the Arts?
Yes.
Because I think like maybe people's only reference point might be Black Swan or something to get a sense of like how intense it is. And so in your case, instead of going off to normal high school, that's where you went off, you're like 14, it's very intense.
Pretty intense. Yeah, it was pretty intense.
So tell me, if you can, like, let's talk about where that turning point is as far as just to show how advanced you got with it and then why you walked away. Because let's talk, what did you do the summer before your junior year?
Starting from 11 or so, I would go off every summer and go to like a ballet intensive for like 6 to 7 weeks. And so, yeah, it was pretty much your whole life at that point. But I did love it. And I'm so lucky that I had that experience. I'm really so lucky. But yeah, so I was in New York doing an American Ballet Theater summer intensive. And I was potentially going to do an apprenticeship at North Carolina Dance Theater and drop out of high school and start doing online classes for my junior year. And
you were offered a apprenticeship?
Yeah.
With people that you really...
really looked up to, like Jean-Pierre Bonfou and Patricia McBride, these two incredible, incredible dancers. And I think a part of me was like got something that I've been working for a really long time and then had a moment of, is this what I actually want? Is this what I want to do with the rest of my life? And
I heard there may have been, and look, there's BS out there as well, so I don't know if this is, this, you might say like, what is this?
Yeah. You're even,
but you're basically having to do 6 days a week of dance.
Yeah.
And then there's that other day of the week and you were still choosing to do dance classes that you didn't have to do. And then there's something with a woman in a wheelchair.
Oh yeah, that's true. It's very dramatic.
Well, no, but it's interesting. Like that's a, like that there is actually a moment where you're like, fuck this.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, okay. So I was studying, doing the 6 day a week kind of thing. And then on a Sunday I would go to Steps on Broadway. I don't know if you're familiar, but it's a pretty incredible place because you have some of the best dancers in the world, you know, better than I would ever have been, you know, principals from New York City Ballet and American Ballet Theater taking class, these open classes. And then you also have people that could be your grandma taking these classes. And it's an awesome environment because of that, I think. But I was in my second class on a Sunday and there was a woman in a wheelchair taking the same class that I was taking. And she was having just the time of her life, you know, and listening to the music and enjoying herself and smiling so big. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. She's not going to get anything out of this class other than just enjoying herself. She's not going to be a dancer or anything like that. And I was pretty unhappy at that particular moment and realized that I was there for all the wrong reasons and that I just wanted to be better on Monday than I was on Saturday. And
why do you like, what were you trying to prove?
I don't know. I just wanted to be perfect, which I'll never be.
But that's no, but I mean, it really is like you hear that a lot with dancers. Yeah. It's like this quest for perfection, which is obviously not attainable.
Of course. Yeah. And I think that's something that's so gratifying about acting is that, you know, not being perfect, being messy and making those mistakes and being human is actually the best part. All the messy things, all the mistakes are what people love. And ultimately, I think having the ability to lose control is actually something that people are kind of striving towards within acting. So it's been a difficult thing for me to wrap my head around at first, for sure. But
well, let's connect the dots. I mean, so you are done. That class was literally the end.
It was. I walked out midway. Well, I started crying. And then I walked out and I didn't go back. And I took the next time I danced was actually 5 years later for Spike Jonze for that Kenzo thing I did.
Okay. So at the time that this break happens, you're in New York. Your family is not. And they, as far as they know, this is what you were dead set on doing. So how did you share the news that this was not going to be what you're going to pursue anymore? And what was the game plan at that point?
Yeah, it was a weird moment for sure. So my dad was already, I left home at 14 and my dad moved to Panama. Mm-hmm. My mom was off working. My brother and sister were in college and I didn't really know what exactly it was I was going to do. There wasn't really, North Carolina. It seemed strange to go back to North Carolina when no one was there. Right. And I didn't really want to, and I really had fallen in love with New York. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote my mom a long email, and I was like, hey, these are my feelings about dance. This is why I want to quit. I don't know what I want to do, but I can get this job because modeling's not meant for me. But I was able to make a little bit of money modeling. And
had that started already, even when you were just doing dance?
It was all very quick. Okay. I was hustling. And I was like, I've secured a potential opportunity to make money here in New York. And I found a school where I could work and go to school at the mm-hmm. same time. And I've reached out to them. And
you'd had it all mapped out.
Yeah, I mapped it all out. So it was really hard to say no to the plan, you know, and it would be the most, you know, stress-free
right.
presentation of my potential future. And I was really fortunate that both of my parents understood and supported me.
Yeah, well, that brings us to the modeling chapter, which also, it seems like it was, again, intense, but this was not a long amount of time. It was like 5 months or something.
Yeah, maybe even shorter. It wasn't too intense for me just because I think I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do, but it was a great way to make a little bit of money and travel and have an excuse to stay in New York.
What I don't get, and maybe it's because I was never doing something at that high a level as what you were doing with dance or then with this, but like you just start modeling.
Yeah.
And within that short period that you were doing it, New York Fashion Week in 2011, Paris Fashion Week in 2012, who were some of the people you were modeling for?
I was really lucky, but I think, honestly, you got to just address nepotism in that field. I mean, like, my mom was a really big model, and yeah. I think, if I'm being honest, that's got to play a huge part in the reason why I was able to work in the capacity that I was able to work in that small duration of time.
Well, I mean, what her most associated thing is L'Oreal, right?
Sure, yeah.
So, but this is like Valentino. Who are some of the places you were actually wearing their stuff on runways?
I did one Valentino show and I think three Chanel shows, and then I called it a day.
What didn't you like about it? Is it just that, I guess with dance, you are doing something.
Yeah.
And here you're sort of
I really like working. Like, I really like having something to sink my teeth into. I really like... Dance is so rewarding because it's physical too. You know, you push yourself and it's kind of this immediate result. And acting's definitely not that. Like, I'll never walk away from set and be like, wow, I killed it. I'm going to walk away feeling super insecure and going through all the things that I should have done differently. But that said, there's still a lot of work to be done around it. And I'm someone that likes to do that.
I'm going to read you back another quote that I came across.
Oh, God.
About the modeling period, just to give us, because, you know, again, I think there are probably a lot of models who are saying, wannabe models or whatever, who are saying, like, that must have been hard to walk away from. What could be the reason? One thing you're saying is, quote, with modeling, there's nothing to work on other than losing weight. I definitely had an eating disorder, close quote.
Okay, here we go.
Here we go.
This is true. I think, so I quit dancing and I started modeling, and I was living alone in New York, and I didn't really know anyone in New York. I didn't know anyone at all, actually. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I really had in my life at that moment was modeling, and that was not something that was filling me up in any sort of way. And I think I came from a very competitive background with dance, and I just translated that into modeling, which didn't make for a very healthy lifestyle. Yeah. And I definitely...
Did you recognize that, or did somebody say to you, like, it's not worth it?
I was alone for a while, so I went to visit my sister for Thanksgiving. My sister Rainsford, and a very talented musician. Mm-hmm. Just go ahead and throw that in there. And she's an actress, too. Yeah. Yeah, she's my best friend in the whole world, and she's an angel. Anyway, I went to go visit her, and I saw her face, and I was super skinny at the time, and she was really worried about me, and I kind of realized, I think it just caught up to me. And that was a big incentive for me to stop, mm-hmm. because it just wasn't worth it for me. And like, having a profession that is strictly based off of your appearance is just not healthy for me.
Or probably anyone.
Or anyone, really, yeah.
And I guess so it was just fortuitous that around that exact same time, probably at that same school that you were referring to earlier, you wind up in an improv class?
It was actually not at that school. It was someone that went to that school, though. Mm-hmm. I started dating someone, and he wanted to bring me to an acting class, and I was a little bit reluctant because, sort of what you were saying earlier, I didn't anticipate following in my mother's footsteps. Mm-hmm. And I went to this acting class, an improv class, and I just loved it so much. And
what do you think it was?
I just had so many feelings.
You can't do anything wrong, right?
Yeah, exactly. That, too. That's a really good way to put it. I haven't really thought about it like that. Yeah, you can't do anything wrong. And so I fell in love with it, and I was like, oh, geez, this is what I really want to do. So I'm going to try my hardest to try to make that happen.
And so what steps do you take at that point?
Being like this very responsible type A person, I was like, oh, okay, well, I will try to go to a good school. So I went to RADA for the summer and studied Shakespeare. And then I went to Los Angeles for a bit. My sister was there. My mom was here at the time. And
what was your mom making of all of this after a lifetime of you not wanting anything to do with this?
She was really supportive, and I'm really grateful for that. And my sister as well, because she's an actress as well, and she helped me so much. She's the person that has run every audition with me to date. And she'll, you know, when I'm going on tape, she'll be the person that's like, no, let's do it a couple more times. Yeah. And it's, I count my lucky stars about her every single day.
So just so, this may be a very random one, but I came across something that I've got to ask you because it sounds like something out of Victorian England or something. I don't, you and your sister in 2011 made your debuts.
Oh, God.
At Le Bal des Debutants, l'Hôtel de Crayon, the Crayon Ball in Paris.
We did both of that. It's very
what does that actually mean? I've always heard about it. I don't even know what that means.
I don't really know what it means, to be honest. I don't know why either of us were invited. We're the least. It's actually just a bunch of real royalty, like literal royalty, that go to this ball in Paris. And, you know, Rainey and I both grew up in North Carolina. And
I feel like this is the thing in the old days where movies, it's like, now go get married. Go find your husband.
Right. It's, but having both grown up in a really small town, we both were invited to go to Paris to go to a fancy ball. And
why not?
We're like, absolutely.
And this was after the modeling was over.
That was before. That was, I think, just as I'm bad about this timeline.
Well, no, it's saying 2011, so it might have been in the, it would have been during, before modeling
was out.
Or maybe,
yeah.
But anyway, that was just a curiosity. So it seems like, I don't know if this was the same person you mentioned that you were dating when you got into improv, but now you're dating another actor and go to visit a set and suddenly you wind up with your first screen role?
Oh, yes. So he was the first person I ever dated. And yes, I visited him on set of Palo Alto.
Yeah.
And
it was Gia Coppola directing. It was like James Franco's stories.
Yes, exactly. And Gia Coppola is so talented and cool. And we became friends. And she asked me if I wanted to just do a real small part in her movie. And I was like, absolutely, I do, Gia.
This was the girl you're playing who, I remember seeing this at Telluride that year, I guess takes away the attention of this older soccer coach, James Franco, from Emma Roberts, who he also shouldn't be involved with.
Right.
But how did you even know how to act for a camera? You'd never acted for a camera before.
Well, luckily I didn't really have to do too much. I just play soccer and then I kind of like am teary-eyed while James Franco consoles me, and that's it. But yeah, she was generous in giving me that opportunity because I definitely didn't know what I was doing.
And as a result of that, suddenly now you're on more radars? Or is it just a coincidence that probably right around that same time you, I guess, get a call about a show called The Leftovers?
Yeah, I don't know that those were related, but I'm grateful regardless. And yes, The Leftovers was my first job and one of my first really big auditions. And yeah, super fortunate to do that.
Familiarize people if they haven't seen The Leftovers on HBO. This was, you're basically playing the daughter of Justin Theroux's character, a mayor who is got this family, and you as the daughter, obviously, understandably troubled by the fact that 2% of the world's population has disappeared.
Not a casual thing.
You know, it's going to have an effect on a kid. But this was from 2014 to 2017, three seasons for you.
I just did two, but it was three seasons, correct.
And just explain the chronology here, because I know that you did go off for a little while to NYU.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the time come
yes.
from.
Yes. So I got the pilot for The Leftovers, and I was so excited, and I had a blast. Peter Berg directed it, and it was kind of a warped idea of what working on set's like, because, or what making a television show or a movie is like, is because Peter Berg does two takes tops, and really? And it's so fast, right. and it was like all handheld, and I was like, great, so this is quick, and then, but I'm really, I think, lucky that I had that experience too, because I was so nervous, and it didn't really give me time to be nervous, because I was just thrown out there. Yeah. So yeah, I did the pilot of The Leftovers, moved back to New York to do that, and then I went to NYU.
Waiting to see if it was going to be picked up.
Right, yeah, I didn't know if it would be picked up, and then it was, and so I stopped going to school and continued doing the show.
And the show was shot in LA?
It was shot in New York.
In New York, so... Mm-hmm.
Okay. The first season, and then the second season was in Austin, Texas.
Okay. And how many months a year would the show shoot? Or just like approximately? Yeah. It was like a lot of your time?
Maybe, I think it was like 4 months.
Okay,
or five
so you
months,
did, because I mean, it was during that run. I was wondering how you'd have the time, but that makes sense that it was during that run that a number of other things got going, including the thing that probably in some ways like introduced you to a lot of people, which would have been this Spike Jonze collaboration that is very cool called My Mutant Brain, which was a ad for the perfume Kenzo World that this hit in 2016. Can you just share how, do you know how he came to know about you and ask you to audition? I was scrolling around last night and not only saw the ad, but the actual original iPhone footage from the first, I guess the first time you met him
yeah.
is also online, and you had it pretty, it looked like you had it pretty down from the first night.
Thanks.
It's like a crazy, just this, I guess I didn't explain the key thing, is like you're dancing like a mad person, right?
That's me. That's you. You can count on that.
Yeah. So like, how does Spike Jonze know about you? Was it from Leftovers?
I think he was just auditioning actors that had some sort of dance background, and I was in that group.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember getting a call, actually I think it was the day of my audition, asking if I wanted to audition for Spike Jonze for a commercial that would involve dance, and I was like, absolutely, I do. And the only thing that they told me about it was that I could potentially end up dancing like a tree, and I was like, okay, sure. Yeah. They're like, you're going to go to his apartment at this time and maybe dance like a tree, and I was like, you got
what,
it.
What, how does one dance like a
I'll
tree?
I'll be practicing yeah. my tree yeah. tree dance for the rest of this afternoon.
Great.
But I got there. Turns out it wasn't really much of a tree dance. He gave me a pitch of the concept for the video. And then he was like, okay, well, would you mind if I just put on the song and videotaped you while you just, we do some improv? And it was one of those moments where I was nervous, but like, if you don't commit and go hard, it's going to be more embarrassing right. than if you, you know, if I did it kind of like half-assed, yeah. I think I would ultimately hate myself more. So I went for it, and it was the middle of winter too. I was wearing a lot of layers and I danced in his apartment for probably like 30 minutes until I'm just covered in sweat.
It was intense.
And
like, he's just shouting at you, like, your right hand doesn't know what the rest of your butt, you're fighting with your right
now
hand.
Now you're a vampire. Yeah. And I'm like jumping on his tables and just making a mockery of myself. And I leave covered in sweat, and my agents call me and ask me how it went. And I was like, well, I either got it or I will, you know, I will never work with this person. And he thinks I'm absolutely insane. Right. One of the two.
Yeah.
He either loved it or really hates me now.
And how quickly did you find out?
Fortunately, I didn't have to suffer for too long.
Too long, right. Yeah. And so the next thing is you guys are at Lincoln Center in like...
It's actually the Dorothy Chandler Opera House in Los Angeles.
Oh, it looked like... Okay. Yeah. Okay.
People think it's Lincoln Center.
Yeah. All right. So you're at Dorothy Chandler. You're wearing a very kind of elegant thing, but I'm assuming it must have been adapted so that you can dance in that, because that was like, or maybe not, maybe it was just a regular fancy dress.
I think that Umberto and Carol, who are the designers for Kenzo, made it specifically for this, so it was something that was pretty really easy to
Movable,
move in.
Yeah. Oh, so amazing. People should go check it out. And it was like with Sia's choreographer,
Ryan Heffington, who he's super talented and just the coolest guy. I actually took dance class this morning at his studio in Silver Lake.
Yeah. Nice. Well, okay, so that was one of the things that was going on during the run of Leftovers. Another thing is a movie that was very funny called The Nice Guys for Shane Black. It's you and two, you know, up-and-comers, Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. How did you – I read something about, like, showing up to audition for this – and understandably finding that a little bit intimidating.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, very scared. Yeah.
Because Gus, like, people I'm sure say to you, like, you know, Brad Pitt or Leo, that must have been just terrifying. But, like, I would think demographically Ryan Gosling might be more...
Oh, they're all terrifying. Yeah. I can't speak in front of any of them. Yeah. No, but, yeah, I did get to that audition, and I did not sleep the night before. And I also had made the mistake, I think, of, like, staying up and rewatching Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and all these amazing Shane Black movies just to really further petrify myself. And then I got to the audition... sleepless and nervous, and Ryan Gosling opens the door to the casting office, and I'm just like, hi, and I immediately feel my face just burning red, and I'm like, I'm touching it, trying to cool it down. I end up filibustering and talking.
Did you expect
about,
that he was even going to be there?
I did know he was going to be there. I didn't find out till that morning, but I knew he was going to be there, and then I was like, oh, great.
And I heard something about macaroon.
Yes, yes. There was everything that could have potentially, you know, he started offering me macaroons. I think I sat down in the wrong chair. I talked about my dad for an hour to try to calm down. And then at a certain point, they're like, okay, well, do you want to go ahead and do this audition? And I was like, oh, you don't want to hear about my dad in Panama for another hour? Because I am
I
still scared.
Yeah. And so, like, do you remember what you had to do? Because just to let people know, you were playing... in this movie, when you did land the part, a teenager who's kidnapped because she's mistaken for a porn star, basically.
True.
So how does one audition for such a role?
It was a pretty generic audition.
Yeah, they just gave
we
you
just
a couple
did
sides.
The sides, and I knew them real well at this point because Rainey had run them with me a bunch. She knew all the lines. Yeah.
And you got that, and that was a very successful movie. And then, but like, I guess a big experience must have been in 2017 to go to Sundance with two movies, Vanishing of Sidney Hall, which is maybe the lesser known of the two, and then Novitiate, which is a really good movie. With it was the first film directed by this woman, Maggie Betts, and you're playing a young woman who is training to be a nun under the oversight of Melissa Leo, who is even more terrifying in this than she was in The Fighter. And just like as the Reverend Mother, just after Vatican II goes into effect, terrorizing these young nuns in training. Maggie Betts said she had already seen 40 girls for the part and was ready to give up because she was just sick of the process, and then decided, all right, just one more, and has described her meeting with you as, quote, one of the more euphoric moments of my creative life.
Aw, Megs.
So why did you two click?
I did just instantly really feel connected to her, and I had it was such a beautiful experience for me making that movie because she's someone who's so intuitive and she directs kind of and like no one I've ever really experienced before. She's really sensitive and subtle and says a lot without having to explain herself very much. And I love Maggie. She's very, very special. It was the first time that I'd worked with pretty much all females, you know, because it was a female director, a female DP, a female in every department head, and female producers, and then obviously an entire female cast, except for one priest, because it takes place in a convent.
And you're the lead of a film for the first time at that point, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so what did you make of that and the character? I was thinking that, you know, in a weird way, the life of a nun in training certainly is not there are some similarities to being a dancer in training. There's no shortcuts, there's no, you know, messing around, right?
No, I think that's really accurate, and I think that's kind of the way that I thought about it and talked about it with Maggie was it's similar to in the sense that they both kind of relish in punishment in a way,
right,
you know.
I've sinned.
exactly. No, it's a really similar mentality when you get down to it.
And just in terms of the, I guess you could call it methody side of this, was there, you know, when the cameras weren't rolling, was there some living the life of a nun in training?
Well, I'm definitely not method or anything like that, but it was an awesome group of girls that I was working with, and we all spent a few nights in the convent and abided by their rules in the sense that we didn't speak after dinner and
Grand Silence.
Grand Silence, exactly.
No cell phones.
No cell phones, and it was really a special experience, and you become attuned to things that I think you generally miss.
And you had a nice way of waking up in the morning.
Melissa Leo, yeah. Melissa Leo knocked on all of our doors.
At 5 a.m.
Yeah.
That's how we all dream of waking up.
That happened. It was awesome.
All right, so Novitiate goes to Sundance, goes over well, gets distribution. How quick do you think did you feel like that had a pop, like that in terms of suddenly you got more offers or interests or whatever, just from a career perspective, did you feel anything after that?
You know, people ask that kind of question a lot, and I don't know. I feel really lucky, and I feel lucky to have any of the opportunities that I've had, and I hope to just keep having the opportunity to work with people that I really admire. But I don't know that I don't think I'll ever feel like, oof, all right. I don't think that's just in my makeup.
All right. Well, so this kind of, in a way, brings us to the current year, because obviously whatever's come out in 2019 was in the works at least in 2018, maybe 2017 as well. And the first thing is Fosse Verdon, which is so good, a FX limited series people can still go and see on demand. You're playing Anne Rankin, the dancer who was both a work and life partner of Bob Fosse. Did they know about, I'm assuming they had to know about your own experience with dance when they came to you?
Yeah, I think it was a similar thing in that they were looking for actors that had some kind of dance background.
And had you heard of, I would guess, as at the level of dancing you had been doing, you probably knew about Anne.
Oh, yes. I watched all that jazz many a time in a back of a minivan on the way to various dance spots as a kid. And I was a big fan of hers, a huge fan of hers, actually. And I've always really loved Fosse style. I think one of the things that makes him so attractive as a dancer is that, and a choreographer, is that he doesn't hide the, you know, we were talking earlier about how ballet is this quest for perfection,
right.
And Bob Fosse is really not that way at all. You know, I think it's my understanding that he initially wanted to be a dancer and then had these various physical limitations and, you know, he didn't have good turnout and then other things that were required to be a star, like a full head of hair and all that kind of stuff. And he, rather than hiding those things, well, I guess he did hide his hair with the hat, but the rest of it, he really accentuated in his style, you know.
It was all in service of the story, right?
Yeah.
That was his big thing.
Exactly. And he became famous for this asymmetry and for this awkwardness and for highlighting the parts of a body that people had formerly and tried to hide.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's so cool that he embraces all the things about a dancer that are technically speaking off about them within the ballet world or the dance world.
So was it a huge process? I mean, this was going to be seven part series, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. It's a very long major endeavor. Was how many hoops did you have to jump through before they said, you know, you're in?
I auditioned. This happens to me a lot, and then they say no, and then and then at a certain point they're like, fine,
whatever.
Come back in. So I did, and I auditioned for Thomas Kail, who is one of the most lovely, talented, amazing people that I've ever met.
Coming off of Hamilton.
Oh
yes.
My God, yeah. Yes. And there was a small dance portion of the audition, and then we did a couple of mock scenes, and he was real kind and gave me a shot.
And in some ways, people say like the scariest part is when you actually get the job in a case like this, because now for the first time, you've got to play a real person who is alive, who you do care what she thinks.
Yeah, someone that I just grew up idolizing and
that's
hung the moon.
Right.
No big deal.
Because like, you know, she is around. She's 69.
Yep.
She's certainly got all her faculties with her, and she was going to see this.
Yes.
So what do you do to prep to make sure that that's as smooth a process as possible?
Okay, so the first intro I had to prep was we started learning the Manson Trio, and
I just have to say, I mean, that is too perfect. Right? I mean, just
apparently
it's
I only do Manson related
things.
Well,
just that Bob Fosse was obsessed with Manson, and so for Pippin has this complicated dance, the Manson Trio, and you then go and do the Manson movie. Same year.
I've been typecast.
anyway, sorry for interrupting, please.
No. So we first learned I learned the Manson Trio, and I was, you know, working with original Broadway legends like Pam Sousa and and Marianne Lamb and all these remarkably talented dancers that I'd idolized for a very long time. And then, so that was my first kind of prep for the show. And then I met Sam and Michelle, and we actually, because the first episode I have stuff to do other than dance is episode 5, and that kind of reads like a play. So we were really fortunate to have the opportunity to go to the set and rehearse. And so I got to meet Sam and Michelle, who I've also looked up to for my...
Sam Rockwell,
yeah,
Michelle Williams.
Yeah, I mean, does little, not get better than that. Like, so, yeah, it was a dream scenario on both ends. And I got Anne's number from Michelle, I mean, from Sam. And I talked to her on the phone about a week before I started shooting.
How does that conversation go?
It was so cool. We talked for probably 2 hours, and she was really generous and let me ask her a bunch of questions. And at the end, you know, she was like, I was basically just telling her how terrified I was and how much I idolized her and how I just didn't want to mess this up. And I got her blessing, and that's
great.
Meant the world to me. And she was like, and honey, if you, you know, need anything, just give me a call, and I'll give you, even if it's just to give a pep talk and tell you just to trust yourself and be honest. And I think I definitely abused that because I called her every week for
the
rest of the show.
What was the biggest thing that she was able to help you understand that you didn't get just from the script? I mean, before you answer, I just have to say the thing that, like, I would have been maybe perplexed by a little bit, and I think that maybe she was helpful here, was like, this guy, as talented as he is consistently cheating on the women in his life. He will not deal with his addiction. He's not an easy character.
No.
And yet both Gwen Verdon and for a period of years were fiercely loyal and sort of defensive and propping up. So, like, why do they put up with that?
Yeah, it's interesting because she's one of the most generous people I've ever talked to. Her heart's huge, and she just leads with her heart in every direction. And she has just an enormous amount of love for both Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon. Mm-hmm. And I've never heard her say one bad thing about either of them. You know, I've heard stories, but even in the stories that she tells, she manages to present everyone in the most positive light that she possibly can. She's really remarkable. So I think, you know, I can't necessarily speak to the way that I personally would view that situation. But as far as having insight to the character, I think I just was wildly impressed by her heart. And just was like, wow, you know, I want to do everything I can to try to honor that.
And was the physical aspect of the character and the dances that were required of you and whatever, you know, did you kind of just slip back into being a dancer, or was it was it very challenging?
You know, I'm sure I definitely could have done better because Anne Reiking, he doesn't get better than Anne Reiking. But ever since I did the Kenzo thing, actually, I've been pretty consistent with dance. Like, I'm definitely not in the shape I used to be, but at least I'm out there, you know. Dude, I hate working out, so the only thing I do really is go to dance class. So I'm not, I could be worse off. I could be worse prepared for the part, or I could have been worse prepared for the part. But it is tricky, Fosse style. It's like, you know, patting your head and rubbing your belly, because it's counterintuitive in certain parts, and it's very specific. It's more challenging than it seems, to be honest. But I had a blast doing it.
How long does a limited series like that take to come together from, you know, how long were you working on this?
I think maybe 3 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess, and then just for point of reference, I guess, you know, movies are not usually that long, but probably with Quentin was probably a longer shoot than most, right?
They had a long shoot for sure. Yeah. You know, I didn't have too long of a shoot. I had more than you would anticipate, just because the style in which Quentin shoots, because he can take his time, yeah. which I think on any other set I could potentially be frustrated by because I'm a little impatient. But on this particular set, yeah. I was grateful for any opportunity to be there and just be a fly on the wall. Yeah, exactly. It's like, also no one has cell phones there, which is great. So it's just everyone's...
He bans it.
Yeah, cell phones are banned. And I often leave my cell phone on my trailer anyway, but I'm alone in that. So I generally end up reading.
Yeah.
But in this scenario, no one had their cell phone, so everyone was forced to talk. And I loved that.
All right, so when along the line, was it during the Fosse-Verdon period that you first heard about, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I'd actually shot that first.
You shot the movie first?
I did Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in the summer, fall, and then Fosse-Verdon that, like, winter, spring.
Okay, so what was going on at the time? I guess that would have been closer to the novitiate, like 2017, 2018, when you are, I guess, going out for this? Like, how did you even first hear there's going to be a Manson project?
I auditioned for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and like I said earlier, with the pattern, I did not get it. And,
but even just being asked, hey, you've got an audition for a Tarantino
movie. Yeah, so cool.
I would think that would be like the big, even if, you know, so what if you get it?
Yeah,
you could say
absolutely.
You did that. Tell
yeah.
the grandkids.
I'm with you. Yeah. Yeah, I was stoked to have the opportunity to audition in the first place. And then I did not get it. Understandable. I didn't expect to. And
when you auditioned, though, did you know who you were? Like, did they say this is the character you are going out for and it's not a real Manson family member, but it's a whatever, Quentin's imagination?
They actually, there was a set of sides and they gave you three various Manson ladies that you could base your audition off of or do your own thing.
Right.
And then they also said, if you want to do something extra, you can do something extra as well. And so I based it off of one of the three that they gave us.
Mm-hmm.
And
did not get
and
it.
I also did something extra. I have a terrible voice. I don't know why I did this to myself. It's like my sister has she sucked all the good voice out of the family. But I sang Always Is Always Forever. Maybe that's why my initial feedback was no.
So they didn't say sing, you just felt inspired.
They said they asked for something extra, and I didn't know what else extra to do. So I found one of the old, you know, I don't know, Charles Manson has an album out. I don't know if you know that, but...
Not like just come out.
No, yeah. He just released his album last week.
Yeah, he's dropping a...
But no, he did have like a strange music career.
Yes.
And so...
You knew that music before this?
I did.
What is that about?
I don't know why I knew that, but...
You got to see your Spotify here. Let's check this out. So you came in and sang his song. Quentin got that.
I think eventually he watched the audition, and saw that. And then I ended up singing it in the movie at some point.
That's right. So, okay, you don't get the part.
I don't get the part.
Is that crushing?
No, because I didn't expect to get the part. I was just like, is this, normal? That makes sense. Why would I? And then I didn't really have anything going on at the moment. And my father lives in Panama, and he was like, well, why don't you book a ticket to Panama? Because then you'll get a Quentin Tarantino movie, was actually what he said
and
verbatim.
And he did not know that you would audition for Tarantino already.
But his general philosophy on life is that if you make plans, then something great will come in the way of the plans that you've
made. He could have said you're going to get a Scorsese movie.
Yeah, absolutely. He just drew an incredible director out of the hat and happened to be Quentin Tarantino. And I was like, ha, ha, ha. Mm-hmm. I actually just didn't get a Tarantino movie, but all right. And,
and I didn't go to Panama either. And look what that did for me. Yeah.
But I did book a ticket to Panama. Me and my sister went to Panama. And then our second day there on the beach, I got a call from my agent. I actually didn't even have cell service. It was very strange, very kind of magical feeling.
Yeah.
And he said that I needed to come home and do a chemistry with Brad Pitt. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, sure, I'll come right home.
Okay, so that you're coming back to do that.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there's a couple of things that I would have thought in that moment. First of all, it's scary. It's Brad Pitt.
Secondly, my dad's a psychic.
A chemistry reading with Brad Pitt, who's, you know, a very youthful and handsome, but like 50-something-year-old guy, and you are 23 at that time?
Correct.
So did you know how this character was even going to be interacting with this stunt guy played by Brad Pitt?
The sides that they gave for the audition
for the chemistry read.
The chemistry read were was the scene in the car. So
okay, so yeah. That was yeah. There's no you cut right to the chase.
Yeah.
There. So you had not previously interacted with Brad Pitt.
I didn't know.
You guys weren't.
We
on
didn't
the
have
same,
a casual friendship.
Same
no.
circuit. So you get there and take us through that.
Okay. They've already started doing the movie at this point because I think I was one of the last people to be cast. Mm-hmm. Like I said, they didn't want to cast me. They ran out of options. And then they're like, well, like, okay. And
no more 23-year-olds. All right.
We've looked around. Yeah. I guess this is the best we've got. And so I went to the stages where they were in production and I hung out until they had a minute to stop shooting. And that time where I was waiting, actually, well, Quentin showed me around the set a little bit, and meeting him was also mm-hmm. I was very starstruck. I'm a huge fan. This is so cool. And then he was like, well, honey, you can go sit over here and it'll just be a minute. And so I sit down on one of the chairs and I'm reading a book, and then I stand up and turn around, and I'm sitting in Leonardo DiCaprio's chair, and I'm like, for the love of God, what is happening? And then ultimately we finally got around to doing the chemistry read. And
what do you do to yourself? Maybe now you're a little more immune to this, but like, all right, you've got to do a chemistry read with Brad Pitt, who you've probably watched your entire life. How do you psych yourself out of being...
I'm not immune to it. I'm sweating right now from doing a podcast. Like,
oh, we're not that. We're not Brad Pitt. Let's be honest. Come on.
Yeah, I'm still nervous, man. No, it was. I think one of the most special things about there's so many special things about Quentin, but one of the really awesome things about him is that he is so enthusiastic about what he does. You know, I was obviously wildly enthused to be there, and he really meets you right there. He's like a little kid on Christmas every day that he shows up to set. So when I got there, he was, you know, taking me on a tour of the set and showing me all the cool stuff that he'd made. And so it's like the cool kids are excited, you know, so I can be unabashedly enthusiastic without, you know, feeling super embarrassed. And I guess I always feel super embarrassed, but I'm just and even Brad Pitt's really excited to be there because it's a Quentin Tarantino movie. Like, there's not anyone that wouldn't be stoked about that experience. So that was disarming.
So now you had a lot of time at the chemistry read, or it was just a quick thing?
It was pretty quick. We did the scene a few times that was it.
How quickly did you find out?
They put me out of my misery pretty soon too.
Okay.
So.
And now you go to work. And actually, before you go to work, Quentin is quite well known for like giving out homework. What did he want you to watch or read or whatever?
He gave me a few DVDs, like documentaries, to watch about the family.
Yeah.
And I did that.
And he did not, though, give anyone except Brad and Leo the entire script, from what I understand. So did you know what this film was even really about?
I got to read the script. I did get
to
read
the
script.
Oh, you did see the full, okay.
But I just didn't get to keep it.
Okay,
I went to his office, and my cell phone was confiscated, and I went to a little room and read it, and it was a blast to read.
Even the ending was there?
Not the ending.
Okay.
So everything but the ending. But I did find out what happened in the end while I was on set, because I wanted to know, and I knew there was something up, and basically... I was like, Brad, come on. What happens? And he was like, he didn't tell me directly, actually. He said, think Inglourious Bastards. And then that was enough. I was like, cool.
Changed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other thing you got to do before you show up there is to learn and then deliver Quentin Tarantino dialogue, which, with the possible exception of Aaron Sorkin, is probably the most like immediately identifiable, but also complex. You're not going to go there and like improvise, I think, right? Maybe.
There was a little bit, actually.
Yeah.
He gives you, I mean, not that I ever should have, because I just, but I don't think anything anyway, okay. But no, yeah, his dialogue is It's like a song. It's like a song. I feel like he's like a really talented jazz musician, and like everything that he's really physical too in his directing. Like everything about him is like this one beautiful orchestrated thing that's like has a rhythm to it that. There you go.
Maybe.
There you go.
Yeah.
But it's the coolest thing ever.
So the scene, you're in some ways like, I think it would be maybe your primary scene in the movie would be the one in the car.
Mm-hmm.
They shut down a highway to do the scene. And with you and Brad in a car, the scene that you had read for to get the part. And now the added element of a couple other things, feet, which is a notorious Quentin, I guess fetish would be the word. And then also, I was sort of surprised that you were more self-conscious about the feet than having to have like a bush of armpit hair.
Yeah, just the feet, man.
Yeah, it was the feet. What is it about? What's wrong with your feet?
I'm a dancer. I wore point shoes for far too long to expose those guys. I don't wear flip-flops. I don't wear sandals at the beach. I'll wear Converse like until I get in the water. A big insecurity for me. And now I feel like I've just had to, you know.
The world
at this
has
point,
embraced your feet.
At this point, there's just like, what else is there? Like, I've shown them in the biggest possible way that I could.
Everything. So, people still like them.
I wouldn't go that far,
well,
but
Quentin,
it's whatever.
I'm
over it now. I have to be.
Okay, so Red, you kept a journal during the shoot. So if we were to get you to cough that up, how would you have generally described this experience of the time that you're there with a cast that can never be really beaten, with the director who's like generational, once in a generation guy.
I've reckoned with the fact that every experience I have from this point on will just be a disappointment. I've peaked.
But I mean, was overall you would have said it in the moment, I'm enjoying this, or I'm stressed, or I'm not confident that I'm doing a good job, or you know what, I'm starting to get better. Like, what would we see there?
Definitely not confident. That's not a word I would use to describe myself. But I was just really grateful for every single day on set. And just, it was a trip. The whole thing was just very surreal. It was mind-blowing and kind of pinching yourself experience. And you know, the journal was just to kind of try to remember everything was happening, because it was just so exciting for me. And I was on cloud nine and trying to take it all in.
Yeah. Film goes to Cannes. I think you were working, so you were unable to be there. So your first, like, taste of seeing this movie with an audience was the premiere, which was on July 22nd, a Monday, following a Tuesday, July 16th, when you woke up and found out you're an Emmy nominee for Fosse Verdon. So how did you process that week?
It was a great week. That was a great week. No, it was an awesome week. Yeah, my dad came in from Panama for the premiere. He'd never been to one of my premieres, so that was really special to have him there. And when I stay in LA, I live with my sister, so we were all just hanging out, and I had a good family time. And I had a blast at the premiere. I got to see Quentin and thank him and give him a big hug. And everyone in that movie is so kind and so just obviously remarkably talented and cool to be around. And then the Emmy thing was exciting. I'm going to be the most stoked Emmy loser out there. And
well, definitely one of the youngest nominees probably ever in that category.
It's super cool. And it was a very exciting week.
Awesome. Well, last question. I was thinking about it and I'm like, you have got to be one of only a handful of young actresses today. Maybe another is Zoe Deutsch, where you are having your own successful career on the footsteps of a mom who has gone through very similar experiences. And I guess I just wonder, having someone that close to you with the benefit of time and experience of seeing what you're getting into, have you had any time to sort of just decompress and have a big picture conversation about like just what could be in store for you, what you hope to do with this opportunity, just what is next?
Well, I think I'm really lucky in terms of my relationship with my mom because we just keep it very much, you know, she's just my mom.
Yeah.
And doesn't we don't really talk about movie stuff too much, which I like. And then in terms of big picture stuff, I have no idea what any kind of big picture thing looks like. I'm just, you know, hoping that we're all still making movies in 10 years and the world isn't ending because, you know,
yes.
the climate
yes.
is just in peril.
Yes. good point. Yeah. That little,
let me just end on a real sad
jazz
note for you.
Fingers or whatever. Yeah.
But no, I just hope to keep working. I really love doing this. It makes me really happy. I care a lot. And I hope to keep having, you know, an opportunity to do what I love.
Well, you're doing a great job. Thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.